Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be back and to have this opportunity to talk about something that I always find fascinating, karma. First, just do a quick check. Can everyone hear me okay? Is the sound coming through all right? Great, good, good. Karma is not only, really important in traditional Buddhist teachings, but it's also fascinating. And one of the reasons I think it's so fascinating for us today is that it doesn't really kind of fit into our mostly naturalistic way of understanding the world. Don't misunderstand me. That doesn't mean it's wrong. I'm just saying that there is a kind of cognitive dissonance between the way we normally understand things and what Buddhism is saying or seems to be saying about sort of the way morality operates. Lots of Buddhist teachings really fit in very well today. They make a lot of sense to us, and indeed, sometimes they make more sense maybe to us than they would have done to some people in the Buddhist time. Teachings about interdependence, which fit in so well with what biology talks about, and not only biology. And even a teaching like anatta. I mean, for me, always the most important teaching of all is the connection that Buddhism makes between dukkha, suffering in the broad sense, and anatta, the delusion of a separate self. And interestingly, this fits in very well with what child psychology has discovered, right? I mean, babies aren't born with a sense of self. That's something that develops. And indeed, if a baby were, say, the mother died and it was raised by wolves, the baby, unless it was quickly found and, brought back into human society, that baby would never develop the kind of sense of self that we have, because our sense of self is a kind of psychological and social construct that depends upon our relationship with other people. But anyway, that's two examples of how Buddhist teachings, I think, kind of fit in a way with our way of understanding the modern world. But what about traditional karma? Karma, I'm talking about it as a kind of impersonal and deterministic sort of moral law of the universe, comparable to, say, the Newton's three laws of motion, something like that. And it's interesting, of course, that that understanding of karma tends to go with physical rebirth, because it's kind of obvious that people don't always get what they deserve in this lifetime. So it seems to imply that there has to be rebirth in order for the karma to work itself out, since we can see that it doesn't always happen here. So it's this fascination. I mean, part of the fascination for me is this cognitive dissonance, or the fact that the physical causality upon which the modern world is based, science, technology, and how everything's work, all of this that we've discovered, there doesn't seem to be any way to fit in karma into that. It doesn't seem part of that world. It doesn't, now that doesn't mean karma is wrong. It just means that it's really offering us quite a different take on the world than our usual understanding. It doesn't disprove karma, or for that matter, physical rebirth, but what it does do is encourage us to think more deeply about them, I think. One reason I like to do that is there are a couple big problems with the way karma has been institutionalized, the way that karma has been used to create situations that I think are problematical. For example, it fits in, it has encouraged a kind of split in, say, Southeast Asian Buddhist societies between laity and the monastics, right? In the Pali Canon, the earliest teachings, it's very clear that the Sangha of practitioner includes not only bhikkhu bhikkhuni, That is to say, male monastics, female monastics, but also laymen and laywomen. But what's happened over centuries is that a split has developed between them. And as is understood today, the role of laity is not to sort of meditate or try to become enlightened, but basically the function, the important thing for lay people to do is to support the monastics by giving them things, right? Dana, you know, food maybe in the morning or money, and that's the main role of the lay people. By doing that, they gain what's called punya, which is usually translated into English as merit, but it's a kind of commodified understanding of karma. And the idea here, the way it's working for the most part, is that by accumulating punya, you can hope or expect for a better lifetime, to be reborn into sort of better circumstances in your next lifetime, maybe in a wealthy family, that would be, or maybe even win the lottery in this lifetime. The problem being, this tends to make Buddhism into a kind of spiritual materialism, because then Buddhist teachings and this way of understanding Buddhist practice, it's used to gain a kind of material reward. Indeed, it encourages, it's another reason why it would be really important to become rich, because if, say, you're really rich in Thailand, you can not only have a very nice life, but you can donate some of your wealth to the Sangha, and then that you will kind of reassure yourself that you'll have an even better lifetime next time around, right? On the other side, it's also had a kind of problematic effect on the Sangha, in the sense that the main role of the Sangha, and maybe I'm exaggerating a bit here, but not very much, but the main role of the Sangha is not so much to practice or even to teach the Dharma to lay people, but for many monastics, what happens is their main job is to become fields of merit. That is to say, it's really important for them to follow strictly all the rules and regulations, because that makes them good monks. And it means if you give, right, if you are going to gain lots of punya if you are supporting, if you are giving to someone who is really a good monk. The idea here being that the amount of merit that you get depends not only on the gift, the dana that you're giving, but also the spiritual status of the recipient. So, for example, you should, according to that principle, you should never give to a homeless person, because by definition, that person must have pretty bad karma. You should always give to the most pious, the most pure monk that you know, because then you will get the most punya in return, right? You can see the problem there. And what something else I find fascinating here is the similarity with the medieval Christian idea of indulgences. You may remember that one of the reasons, or one of the main reasons, Luther started a Protestant Reformation was because he was so unhappy with the fact that the church was selling indulgences, right? It meant that you could get a piece of paper, and if you gave a certain amount of money to the church, or then the indulgence meant that your father or grandfather in purgatory would have to spend less time there, that you could thereby get into heaven more quickly. You can see kind of the problem with that, and I think it's the same kind of problem, commodifying karma. I mean, the one is negative, the one is positive, but both involve a kind of commodification that works to the benefit of the religious organization. But we still have to ask, is this really a good way to understand karma? Is this really a good way to understand how, say, something like purgatory would work for Christianity? Obviously, there's a lot more to the teachings of both the Buddha and indeed Jesus. So that I see is quite problematical, but there's an even greater issue that has important implications for how it is that Buddhism is going to respond to its role its more global role today and in the future. It's the fact that karma can be and has been used to rationalize racism, caste, economic oppression, birth handicaps, authoritarian rulers, and so forth, right? You could say that if you take karma literally, it can justify the authority of political elites, right? I mean, if somebody is born a prince, must have really good karma, and you know, if that prince becomes king, it's because of that good karma, and the implication being, well, then we should probably do what that prince says. But the other side of it is, it also, so it seems to imply our own subordination, right? That's interesting. I think that points a lot to why it is that caste remains such a volatile issue in India, if you think about it. It's like the high caste people, they really believe they're high caste for a reason. They deserve it. They worked hard in previous lifetimes. And low caste people, they're there for a reason too. They deserve it. And so high caste people don't like the idea of, you know, why should we give these privileges, or why should we give them equal opportunity? They're getting what they deserve. It provides a kind of perfect theodicy. If there's an infallible cause and effect relationship between your actions and your fate, then in a way there's no need to work for social justice, because it's sort of built into the universe. It'll work itself out. And it even sort of implies that there's no undeserved suffering, in which case there's no evil that we need to struggle against. All of this kind of built into the idea that, depending on how you understand karma, but if you understand it in that all sort of broad encompassing sense. I remember once listening to a Tibetan teacher talking about the Holocaust in Nazi Germany during World War II, and sort of thinking, oh, what terrible karma all of those Jews in Nazi Germany must have had to be born at that time in that place in order to suffer that fate. And I just think, okay, I can see how traditional understandings of karma can be used to rationalize that, but I think that's that kind of fundamentalism which blames the victims and rationalizes their horrific fate, I think that's something that we should no longer tolerate. I think it's time for Buddhism and modern Buddhists to outgrow that by accepting responsibility and trying to address those kinds of injustices. But anyway, putting it all together, what I've tried to do is simply explain why karma, especially the traditional ways of understanding karma, and the ways that it's been institutionalized now, that it's a problem. It's a problem for contemporary Buddhism. And I think that if we are honest with ourselves, many of us aren't really sure how to take it. I mean, it does seem to be an essential part of traditional Buddhism. It's very clear in the Pali Canon. Although, you know, it goes back to this whole question. Well, if everyone in those days was believing in karma and rebirth, is it really the case that the Buddha experienced this for himself, or is the case that it was simply taken for granted and maybe it's not so essential for us to believe in it, at least in that traditional literal form? I mean, I'm reminded here, my own teacher in Japan, Yamada Koen Roshi, I'm trying to remember if he ever talked about karma or rebirth, and I don't think he ever did. I don't know whether he was being expedient in some way, you know, that he was teaching a bunch of Westerners who maybe would have balked at it, but he never actually talked about either concept. Here I'm reminded of something that the mythologist Joseph Campbell said, which I think is really important. He said, a lot of the problems in religion happen because people take metaphors literally. I mean, that's an interesting thought, and it raises the question, what if karma could be understood more metaphorically? What might that mean? What other ways of understanding karma are there that maybe don't fit into the, you know, the idea of karma as this sort of cosmic law of cause and effect that sort of always works itself out perfectly? And in fact, I think asking this question is actually remaining true to the best of the Buddhist tradition. In the Kalama Sutra, sometimes called the Charter of Free Inquiry, the Buddha emphasized the importance of intelligent probing doubt. He said, we shouldn't believe something just because somebody says it, including him, but we should accept it when we have established its truth for ourselves. Saying this doesn't mean sort of disparaging or dismissing Buddhist teachings about karma, but it does highlight for me the importance of sort of interrogating it. Given what we now know about human psychology, including what I was alluding to before, the idea of this kind of social construction of the sense of self, is there another way of understanding karma that is still very insightful, but doesn't require understanding it as some kind of cosmic law? Is it maybe a kind of a psychological law or a psychological principle about the way the sense of self functions? So that's basically what I want to do in the rest of this talk. I want to propose a different way of understanding karma, which I think makes a lot of sense. And I certainly wouldn't say it's the only way of understanding karma, but for me, there's something really meaningful about it, and I'm happy to share it. Okay, when we go back to the original Sanskrit term, karma, and it's the same term in Pali, kamma, it literally means action. And that's quite interesting because in our everyday use of karma, actually, we're not talking about the action, we're talking about the result, right? If I ask you, or I say, that's your karma, or what's my karma, we're thinking about the result of something that we did. Whereas the actual original term, kamma, karma, is emphasizing the action. In other words, I wonder if we've got it backwards by focusing so much on the result. And there are other words in the Sanskrit and the Buddhist languages, right, for the result, right? There's vipaka is the karmic result. There's also phala, the fruit of action. But by have we kind of missed the point by focusing on the result rather than on the action and how it is that the action is performed, right? The basic point is of karma is simply that actions have consequences, in particular that our sort of morally relevant actions have morally relevant consequences that extend beyond their immediate effects. You could say that in the popular understanding, the law of karma is a way to get a handle on the world, on the way the world will treat us in the future, which sort of implies accepting our situation right now, whatever is happening to now, because it's a consequence of what we did earlier, which can be quite disempowering, right? I hope that made some sense, but my point here is I think that's missing the truly revolutionary significance of what the Buddha was pointing at. I think one of the really most important things that the Buddha had to offer was a new way of understanding karma, which emphasized the importance of intention and our basic motivation, right? At the time of the Buddha, we know that there were different religious sects, like the Jains. They believed in karma, but they believed it was all mechanical, right? If you injured or killed some living being, there was a karma built into that, quite apart from whether you intended to do it or even knew you were doing it. And the Buddha's revolution, and I really want to try to give us a sense of how powerful this was to emphasize the importance of motivation and intentionality. And that leads me to what I think is the most important point about karma, that it's best understood as the key, a key, maybe the key to our spiritual development in this sense. If we understand karma in the right way, it shows us how our life situation can be transformed by transforming the motivations behind what we do. Let me say that again. Karma is best understood, I think, as the key to our personal spiritual development, how our life situation can be transformed by transforming the motivations behind what we do. By transforming the motivations, we end up in a different world. I think this points to a really deep truth that we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are, right? My favorite example here, the difference between a pickpocket and a Buddha, right? If you're in a crowd, what's a pickpocket going to see? If we're in a crowd, what is a Buddha going to see? They're probably going to be picking up on very different things, aren't they? There's also a famous story about somebody who went to hell, and he saw how people were trying to eat food there. There was this delicious huge table, you know, covered with all kinds of delicious dishes. But the problem was all the people sitting around weren't able to eat it because they had chopsticks and the chopsticks were much too long. And somehow they couldn't manage to get the food and put it into their mouth because it wouldn't fit. I don't know why they just didn't use their hands, but that, anyway, that's not in the story here. And how afterwards that same person was shown how heaven works. And in heaven, the interesting thing was it was exactly the same situation. It was the same table, the same delicious food, but the only difference was the people with chopsticks, these huge, long, elongated chopsticks, they were using the chopsticks to feed each other. Same situation, but different motivation, different attitude, experiencing the world in a very different way. As Shantideva, one of the great Tibetan teachers, said, all the suffering there is in this world arises from wishing oneself to be happy, right? Trying to get that food. All the happiness there is in this world arises from wishing others and helping others to be happy. I guess the point of these stories, you know, showing just how incredibly important intentions can be. But let me backtrack a little bit here and ask, go back to this Buddhist concept of not-self or non-self, right? In modern language, the idea that the sense of self we have is a psychological and social construct. It's basically composed of, you know, mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting, right? Now, if we ask, okay, given there's all these different habits that sort of work together to create and sustain this sense of self that I have, what are the most important habits? What are the most important elements of this construct of self? The ones that most affect how we perceive other people, how we experience them and the world, and how that world responds to us. And I think the answer pretty clearly is, yeah, the most important components of the sense of self are our basic attitudes to others in the world, our basic motivations, our basic intentions. From this perspective, we could say that karma is not something that the self has. Rather, karma is better understood as what the sense of self is, insofar as it's sort of integrated into our habits, into the kind of person we are, the way we relate to the world, right? And what my sense of self is, that therefore changes according to my conscious choices, according to my intentions and the habits that develop out of those, right? In other words, by changing my motivations, by changing my intentions, I'm going to become a different person. And again, remember what I said before, when I become a different person, I see the world in a different way, right? I, therefore, this is one way to put it, I reconstruct myself by what I intentionally do. Because my sense of self is a kind of precipitate. It's out of these habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting, right? So just as my body is composed of the food that I eat, that's digested and absorbed and assimilated, so you can say my character is composed of conscious choices that then become habitualized. I am constructed by my consistent, repeated mental attitudes, by my motivations, by the motivations that become habitual. There's an anonymous verse, a little four-line verse that I love because it expresses it so well. I don't know where it comes from. I've never been able to find the source, but I think it gets at the heart of the issue. Sow a thought and reap a deed. Sow in the sense of like broadcasting when you're out, planting field, you sow a seed. Sow a thought and reap. This is what you get in return. You reap a deed. Again, karma all about cause effect, right? Sow a deed, this is the next highest level, sow a deed and reap a habit. Sow a habit and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. To unpack that, you could say something like, what I do is obviously going to be motivated by what I think. Intentional actions, when I repeat them over and over again, they become habits. And habitual ways of thinking, feeling, and acting and reacting, they construct my sense of self, my sense of who I am. Of course, the difference is the last line. It doesn't mean it's going to control my destiny. But nonetheless, the kind of person I am, although it doesn't fully determine what occurs to me, it does strongly affect usually what happens as well as how I respond to it. Anyway, I hope this makes some sense. I also think it sort of helps us understand the importance of something like confession and repentance. They are important because they are our way of acknowledging both to others and to ourselves that what I did was a problem, that it wasn't a good thing to do, and I acknowledge that I'm striving not to allow that to become or remain a habitual tendency that is a part of my sense of self. I mean, if confession and repentance are done genuinely, that's in effect what they are saying. Now, as I think I mentioned earlier, karma and rebirth usually go together, but you will have noticed that this understanding of karma doesn't necessarily involve another life after physical death. I'm reminded of something the great Jewish philosopher Spinoza, at the very end of his great book, The Ethics, the very last proposition, he says happiness, the original word is beatitude, blessedness, serenity. It's been understood in many ways. Anyway, let's call it happiness. Happiness, he says, is not the reward for virtue. Happiness is virtue itself. I think this way of understanding karma sort of helps us understand that. It's easy to make fun of what Spinoza said, right? But his point about happiness or beatitude or serenity, it's talking about a certain state of mind in which we are virtuous. And it's not as though we do the virtue because we expect God to reward us sometime in the future after we die or in a future lifetime, but just that whole basic attitude involves a certain way of being in the world that is itself meaningful. It doesn't require being rewarded, right? Or as you could say, we are not punished for our sins, but by them. Actually, that doesn't really work in Buddhism because the idea of a sin, literally, karma isn't about sin, it's about cause and effect, strictly speaking. But the basic idea here is, as I said, to become a different person is to experience the world in a different way. When your mind changes, the world changes, and when we respond differently to the world, in general, the world responds differently to us, right? So insofar, and this is sort of getting into a bit more into the metaphysics, insofar as we are really non-dual, we're not separate from the world. Therefore, our ways of acting in it tend to play and reinforce sort of feedback loops, right? That incorporate other people. People not only notice what we do, they notice why we do it. I mean, maybe I can fool people sometime, but over a while, people will get a sense of who I really am and why I do what I do. In other words, my intentions, my motivations will sooner or later be revealed. They will become obvious, right? So if I am motivated in a selfish way, if I'm motivated by, say, the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion, then I need to manipulate the world to get what I want out of it, right? And consequently, interestingly, there's a kind of karmic result built into that, because by manipulating the world and manipulating other people, I'm creating this sense of alienation, of separation from other people, right? If I'm relating to you in that way, obviously I'm going to feel more separate, and you're going to feel more separate too. It encourages both sides to sort of manipulate. But think about the opposite. Suppose that I'm motivated not by greed, but generosity. Not by ill will, but loving kindness for everyone. Not by the delusion of a separate self whose well-being is separate from yours, but the realization, the wisdom of realizing that our well-beings are not separate from each other. If I'm motivated by that, well, think about it. I don't have to play games with you. I don't have to manipulate the situation. I can open up. I can relax. The more I feel part of the world and genuinely connected with other people, the less I'm going to be inclined to use others. And likewise, people are going to pick up on that. They're going to be more inclined to trust me, to open up to me. I hope you can see what I'm getting at here. The point being that transforming my own motivations not only transforms my own individual life, it's also going to affect the people around me, because we're not really separate from each other. As I said earlier, that the problem with that little verse that I quoted earlier, the one that ends with, sow a character and reap a destiny, it doesn't always work that way, right? I mean, you could be a really wonderful person, wonderful Jewish person in Nazi Germany, and you've been caught up in social political forces that can destroy you. So being a person of sterling character doesn't guarantee, that there's going to be a certain kind of result in the world, right? In the usual karmic sense of, like, if I'm a really good person, the world is always going to treat me really well. Part of the attraction, I think, of the traditional way of understanding karma, and also even in Christianity, the idea of, being good and not committing sins, it seems to give us some sort of control over our destiny. The belief that really, if we act in a certain way, that everything will work out okay. And we really want to believe that. Work out okay, not only in the Spinoza sense, but in the sense, but in the sense that we will eventually, lead to some kind of blissful situation. But I mean, again, does the cosmos really have a moral structure? I can understand why Buddhists, why Christians want to believe that. Or is it simply the case that the cosmos is more complex, more ambivalent, maybe even we can say more tragic than that? And maybe that's the basic question, right? Do we understand whether morality is sort of built into the very structure of the universe? The reality, of course, is that I don't know. But in a way, it doesn't make any difference in terms of what we, each of us, what the Buddhist tradition offers us about how to live, right? The emphasis on being compassionate, upon being generous, upon being really concerned to reduce suffering. Whether that somehow fits into some deeper reality about the universe wants us to do that, or if that's simply something that we existentially decide to do, I don't know the answer, and In a way, I don't know how I could know the answer in any simple sense, but it seems to me the task, my task is the same in either case, right? To live compassionately, to live in a loving way, to do what I can to reduce dukkha for everyone. Please understand that everything I've said so far, it doesn't mean that I reject cosmological karma or physical rebirth. For me, they really are examples of don't know mind. I kind of, in a way you could say I put them on a shelf, but the reality is one of the wonderful things about the Buddhist tradition, it doesn't matter, right? They're still the same task. I still face the same task in terms of the importance of doing the very best that I came as I can right here and now. Look, you don't have to believe in karma, right? If karma works, it works. It works whether or not you believe in it. It's a kind of reverse Pascal's wager. Whether or not you believe in it, the bottom line is to do the best we can, since it really doesn't matter. Here I'm reminded of that famous story of Einstein and the horseshoe. A visitor to Einstein noticed that he had a horseshoe tacked above his entrance point, you know, the idea being that the horseshoe would bring good luck. And the visitor was quite shocked and he said, Dr. Einstein, you don't really believe that a horseshoe will bring you good luck, do you? And Einstein said, no, of course I don't. But I'm told it works whether you believe it or not. I guess that's karma too. It works whether we believe it or not. So, to finish, and I guess I'm saying it again, this kind of more naturalistic, psychologistic understanding of karma doesn't mean that we have to exclude other more sort of mysterious possibilities about how motivations function in the world, right? There may well be other aspects of karmic cause and effect that are not easily understood or maybe not understandable at all. But what is clear, I think, in either case, is that understanding karma in this way, as karma is how to transform my world, my life in the world by transforming my motivations right now, right? The important thing is to see that that's not a fatalistic doctrine, right? Quite the contrary, I find it extremely empowering because it encourages us not to just accept the problematic circumstances of our lives, but we're encouraged to improve our situation, our spiritual lives and worldly situation by addressing whatever those circumstances may be with the kind of positive habits that will create the kind of benevolent, wholesome motivations and intentions that I've been talking about, right? To respond to those situations as they arise with generosity, loving kindness, and non-dual wisdom. I think it was the Dalai Lama who said, "You should be kind whenever you can, and you always can." Thank you for your attention.